am going to commit a Unitarian Universalist sin and talk about money. Actually, I don't think it's a sin at all, but it certainly seems that way at times. Every congregation I've been a part of has had to talk about money, and only one of them, out of about eight that I've been actively a participant in, did it particularly well. How did they do it, you may ask? Well, I'll come to that in a few minutes, but you gotta stick around. Before we can talk about how to talk about money, well, we need to first get into the nitty-gritty of why money is such a pain to talk about in the first place. There are a lot of reasons, and I could do multitude of sermons on all the different reasons, and I'm sure you wouldn't come to half of them. So I want to focus on what I think is one of the most important ones. One of the most significant reasons can be summed up in one word: shame. There is some degree of shame in talking about money. The shame is so great that few people who talk about money in the public square actually tend to go over the top when they do so. You can think of people like Donald Trump, everybody's favorite narcissistic man, or the Kardashians flaunting in every avenue of their lives all of the glamour and glory that they supposedly have. Or, as was announced this week, the ability to purchase $75,000 cologne. Extravagance is frowned upon, and people with money made out as caricatures of some mythological rich person who, quite frankly, does not exist. Wealthy people are mythologized as egotistical control freaks who only look after themselves. We come by this mythology from thousands of years of assumptions. Listen to these words of Aristotle. He wrote, "Wealthy men are insolent and arrogant. Their possession of wealth affects their understanding. They feel as if they had every good thing that exists. Wealth becomes a sort of standard of value for everything else, and therefore they imagine there is nothing it cannot buy. In a word, the type of character produced by wealth is that of the prosperous fool." Who would want to talk about money after that? It is not a surprise, then, that many wealthy young adults pretend they are not rich while in college. The shame of having money can be great. Actually, there are wealthy people who talk about money, and they do it quite well, but they are rarely lifted up as an example of health in our society. I think of Bill and Martha Gates, who utilized their money for important good causes. For J.K. Rowling, who gave so much money that she ceased being a billionaire. The truth is that having money is not evil, and the people who have money are not inherently bad in some way. They are not that mythological other that is so often talked about. Like all things, people are people. And it isn't the having of money so much as the what you do with it that might say something about who you are as a person, who you are as a spiritual person, even. One would think that with all the shame available for those who have money, that those without money would be lifted up as models of morality. Of course, there's more than enough shame to go around. Those without money are portrayed as inherently unintelligent, lazy, moochers who are dirty and without value. Young adults from poor families are equally likely to hide their status in college. The shame of not having money can be great. And then there are those who are in the working and middle classes who have just enough money to lead a reasonably good life, as long as they keep saving and they keep working. In this world, people live one or two paychecks away from being homeless or without a vehicle. You might even have enough to carry you on for some time, but the fear of being without can be equally tricky. Here, too, shame can exist. Shame over not having the right kind of clothes or car or Xbox games. The shame of having come from a family of poverty or wealth into the middle class. The shame of living comfortably while others suffer. The shame of having enough money can be great. Now, not everyone feels shame for money. Some of you are listening to this and thinking, why would you feel shame about money at all? That said, I'm willing to guess that most everyone here, at some point in their lives, has had a moment of discomfort when talking about or dealing with money. It is woven into our society, and it is messy and complex, like everything else. We will scratch the surface of this today, and as we discuss the role of shame in relationship to money, and money as a spiritual and ethical aspect of our lives, keep in mind that shame is a feeling and not a fact. Let's talk about shame for a minute. One of the most alarming realities of our society is the lack of skill we have in speaking about emotions. We do not teach it, and we have not learned it very well. Unless you have gone to a therapist day in, day out, for weeks on end, you likely do not have the daily skills to be able to describe your emotions. Or maybe you're lucky enough to be a poet who can give you 50 shades of angry and sad. But for most of us, emotions can remain elusive. For example, there is a stigma around anger, particularly in the Midwest. And it is so extreme that we fail to recognize that there are degrees of anger. Anger is presumed to mean that you are loud, violent, and aggressive. What this actually describes is a variation of anger that could be described as fury or rage. Anger has lower levels, such as irritation or annoyance or frustration. Some of you may be feeling that towards me now. Not all anger is created equal. In fact, anger recognized at lower levels and met with self-compassion can prevent fury, rage, and violence. Shame is the extreme enactment of fear of lack of self-value. The best researcher on this subject today is Dr. Brené Brown. Do we have any Brené Brown fans in the house? I encourage everybody to at least go and listen to her TED Talk. She's spectacular. She's just a wonderful storyteller. She's fun to listen to. She is a licensed social worker with a doctorate focused on shame research. In her research, she differentiates between four words often used to describe the same thing: embarrassment, guilt, humiliation, and shame. You do not need to remember all four of those, but do pay attention to how shame differs from each one. Embarrassment is what you feel when you make a mistake or do something silly and can brush it off. It does not make a statement about who you are as a person. It happens to the best of us. For example, falling up the stairs or spilling coffee might lead to embarrassment. I know I've actually fallen up these very stairs and felt embarrassment. It is a low level and easily forgotten or made into a funny story down the road. You all have examples of that in your lives. For example, I was once driving across country and saw my very first mountain in Albuquerque. But I really wasn't sure it was a mountain because I thought they'd be bigger. I was embarrassed when I asked the gas station clerk if that was a mountain or not. Embarrassed, but not much more. Low level, so much so that I could share that story with you today. Guilt occurs when we make a mistake and we feel bad for having made that mistake. Religion speaks to guilt most frequently. And some of you may have Catholic guilt or Jewish guilt or, you know, all the varying kinds of guilt that are out there. That's not quite what guilt actually is. That's how religion has termed it. Guilt is just those times when you've made an honest mistake and you feel bad about it. And maybe you need to go and make amends or apologize or do something differently, take an action that will resolve that guilty feeling. Guilt is actually a healthy emotion that can be a guidepost to changing behavior in a way that allows us to live better and more whole lives. Humiliation occurs when someone calls you out or people laugh at you for something you feel is unfair. Brené Brown gives this example. A teacher calls out a child who has forgotten to put their name on the paper. Look, do everybody see this piece of paper? See, it doesn't have a name, but we all know whose name it should be there. It's Billy. Billy never remembers to put his name on his paper, does he? And the teacher humiliates him in front of the entire class. Billy can have one of two responses. One is humiliation. And in humiliation, he is angry at the teacher. And he tells his friends about it, and he'll even tell his parents about it, because he felt humiliated and that it was unjust, that it wasn't a fair thing to do. Humiliation, again, does not become an internalized dialogue about who we are as people, but more about how others treat us. Shame, on the other hand, makes a statement about who we believe ourselves to be. It is our deepest fear about ourselves turned inward. Take the story of the same child, Billy, forgetting his name on his paper. The teacher calls him out in front of the entire class. And he may likely respond with, "Yeah, she's right, I'm stupid, I'm an idiot. I deserve to be treated this way." And Billy doesn't tell anyone, because it's not news. Shame is not news. It is not a surprise. It is often challenged because often not challenged because we assume it's just how things are, but it's simply true. Shame's greatest reinforcement is silence. Breaking the silence is its downfall. Shame has controlled the conversation for our society in many arenas. Why are so few rapes reported? There are a lot of reasons, but one is certainly shame. People believing that they deserved it or they asked for it. Internalizing the message of what others have said about them. A belief that if they speak up, it will only confirm to the rest of the world what they believe about themselves, that they are naturally depraved, deserving of what they have received. And of course, I hope we know that's not true. Why do people fear sharing that they live with mental illness? Shame that what society says about people living with mental illness may be true about them. Not being able to see that society is wrong. Silence helps maintain shame. And we see repeatedly the power of speaking out against shame in the civil rights movement, even in the actions in Ferguson. We see it in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer movements, in the women's movements, and so many places where people have spoken out and shared what is happening, risking all, being vulnerable, encountering the shame in their own lives. People who risk vulnerability for freedom from that cage are people who are known as shame resilient. You know those moments when you're shame resilient. It's when you disrupt that dialogue. You go to someone you really trust, someone who will hear you for what you are saying, and share that deepest fear. Shame resilience is the courage to share what is happening in our daily lives. It refers to a person's ability to recognize shame and use it as a signpost for personal healing and growth. Shame resilience involves embracing vulnerability and courage in one's daily life. Two of my favorite shame resilience experts are Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. Any Macklemore fans in our house? For those of you who do not know, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis are hip-hop artists, perhaps most well-known for the song Same Love, which helped transform the social conversation towards acceptance of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer peoples, and their right to marry. Macklemore in particular writes songs that share his personal struggles with drug and alcohol addiction, as well as society's addiction to money and to things. His lyrics show vulnerability in the face of a world that might judge him for his ideals. In one song, he shares his shame at relapsing on alcohol. He meets a young woman who has found his music to be an important support to getting sober herself. And he writes, "If I can be an example of getting sober, then I can be an example of starting over." He recognizes his shame, but fails to let it control him and his life. So about that money. We have a society invested in maintaining shame around money. Shame around having it, the desire to have it, or the reality of not having it. Men are often expected to make money for their family, Any failure to do so is treated as a statement of the men themselves, rather than on the system that assumes that there will be poor people so that other people can have things. Shame helps us lose track of systemic realities. In other words, we blame the trees rather than looking at what is going on in the entire forest. Shame is painful. It's antagonizing and quiet, and frequently only exists in our own personal realms of awareness, unless we are willing to speak. When it comes to money, this often leads to a cultural value of silence. If we do not talk about politics, sex, or money, then we won't have any problems, right? Wrong. The silence leads to missteps and judgments that can hurt real lives. This congregation has had some difficult financial history. It had difficult times with money and has seen the real impact it can have on lives. I must admit some anxiety of my sharing this particular story, but I think it's important for us all to hear. Many of you are aware that some years ago, a member of this congregation was convicted of stealing money from another member. This person ultimately took his own life. What a traumatic event for him and his family, and for this congregation in its relationship to money. What shame existed there? What is clear in the retelling of the story that I've heard from many here gathered today is that no one really knew what to do in the face of this event. Cleaver even shared, not being sure what to do. How do we respond when such egregious acts occur? And what do our values tell us as Unitarian Universalists? Well, first, our values tell us one simple thing. There is no one right or wrong way to address this stuff. We wouldn't agree on it anyway. We can respond like a business would, but we are not a business. We could respond like society would, but we've already established that they don't know what they're doing. To move this a little further away from home for a moment, I think of the Enron people who kept scamming money again and again and again. Upon further research into the events, it was discovered that these were not inherently bad people out to scam money. However, the competitive and covert nature of their jobs led them to push further and further and see what they could get away with. It became a game. So far removed from real people and actual physical money, it became a game in which it was easy to dissociate from the impact of their actions. This is often the cornerstone of employee theft in businesses. The ability to get away with it, to rationalize it, and to access it. And in that world, where it becomes a game and it's not about real people, taking that money can become easy. And this is one place where Unitarian Universalist values can be helpful. We believe in the power of community. We believe in the power of beloved community. We focus not on what each person personally believes, but on how we relate to one another as a community. So how do we respond to those who commit egregious financial actions that break up relationships? Honestly, the first thing we do not do is keep the silence. We break it. We focus not on what each person, we first respect the inherent worth and dignity, and then call the people back into relationship with clearly defined boundaries and ramifications for actions. We strive for community always while respecting the individuals involved. The story of Cain and Abel gets at the heart of the confluence of what we have to offer the world. Cain and Abel give offerings to God, to someone they care about and from whom they want respect. God is impressed with one offering, but not the other, even though they both had worked hard to create their offerings. In this story, we see an age-old theme played out. We do not trade in actual animals or vegetables anymore. Instead, we use money. Yet while the means of trade has changed, the basic valuing of personhood has not. Money is seen as a translation of what we have to offer the world. When we have not, we can be like Cain and grow angry, shameful, and jealous. Here is the truth. Money does not determine worth. Your worth is not in your offerings. What would have happened if God said, I love you for giving what you can? You are not your money. You are not a bad person for having or having not. Money is not the root of evil, nor is it the bastion of goodness. When we treat it in this way, we become like Cain, brooding and vengeful. My question is how God fits into all of this. What kind of a God fails to offer recognition for hard work? Another question is, who is God symbolizing in our own lives? When we have such an uncomfortable relationship with money that we cannot talk about it, for whom is God the metaphor? For you, it may actually be God, or it may be a parent or a friend who taught you to shame money, or it could be an experience that was difficult and painful in talking about or transacting with money. We fear what we believe may be true about money in ourselves. And so what do we do about all this? We break the silence. We talk openly and honestly about money. We take steps to let go of the negative connotations and assumptions that lead to the class of society in which we live. Remember earlier when I mentioned that I was part of one congregation that talked about money well? It was not because there wasn't shame or struggle or difficulty in talking about money. It was because they engaged in a very simple spiritual practice, acting as if. But in other words, fake it until you make it. Important spiritual practice. Acting as if. When we believe or think something is true but are not quite feeling it yet, we act as if. When this congregation requested the congregation that spoke of money well, requested a pledge from all members from the moment that member signed the book. They talked about valuing all money, whether it was $1 or $1,000 a month. They encouraged children to give a part of their allowance to the church. Fundraisers were loud and proud events where all people could attend regardless of income. A small trusted team of members, along with the minister, were aware of who pledged and how much, and were tasked with showing gratitude to all people for their pledges. Regular gratitude was shared for all financial gifts. Money was talked about from the pulpit and between the people. The language of giving and gratitude were used as if they were true, even if not everyone was quite there yet. And this was a Midwestern congregation. I promise you, they weren't there yet. Because people talked about money openly, it became easy to create checks and balances for fiscal accountability. No one person was left responsible for the money because it was clearly understood that the community, all of the community, whether you want to be a part of it or not, were stewards of their own resources. That congregation still acts as if today. As Reverend J. Cliff Christopher puts it, money is a reflection of our spiritual lives. As Unitarian Universalists, we do not believe in good and evil as such, so money cannot be evil, nor can it be an inherent good. We do not support the prosperity gospel that states God gives money to those who are good. We do not support a notion of money that is evil in and of itself. The way money is reflected in our spiritual lives is in the same way it is reflected in our personal relationships with one another. Our money is a statement of how we want to be together in all of our fiscal diversity. We provide for our families as best we can. We pay to support the work of the church as best we can. We give to organizations that represent our values as best we can. And we recognize that individually, we may not be able to accomplish much with our money, but when pulled together, it can feel good to give. And that, truthfully, is the best way to consider your pledge, your gifts, your time, your skill, your money given to this church, to organizations in your lives, to even to your own family. Give until it feels good. I want you to say that. Give until it feels good. This is also to help you wake up, because I've been talking a lot. Give until it feels good. Very good. There you go. Don't listen to the voices that say they will judge you because you are wealthy. There you go. Don't let fears of scarcity and loss hinder your relationship to the world. I'm not feeling it. It doesn't sound good at all. It sounds painful. Give until it feels good. Let's try that again. Excellent. I almost believe you. All right. Let's try that again. Don't listen to the voices that say they will judge you because you are wealthy. Don't let fears of scarcity and loss hinder your relationship to the world.
Give until it feels good.
Don't give until it doesn't feel good anymore either. You got it. Act as if your relationship to money is positive until one day it is. Until it feels good to give what you can give. Until it feels enough. Church is not here to make you happy. I will warn you right now, I have zero intention of making you happy. If you don't like that, you probably shouldn't be here. The people in this room do not come to this church with the intention of making you feel happy. If you don't like that, you probably shouldn't be here. That said, giving to a community that you love in good times and difficult times can feel good. It is our seventh principle lived. Our seventh principle states we affirm and promote the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. Through the gathering of our financial resources, we help support that web. Through the gathering of our financial resources, we make this community possible. Each gift adding to the abundance of our beloved community. May it always be so, and
give until it feels good.
You lost some energy. One more time.
Give until it feels good.
Amen. Or blessed be, or whatever you're comfortable with.